Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collections, and I'd like to welcome all of you for coming out this evening for what I think is going to be a wonderful reading. Tonight is the last reading of fall semester 2002, but we have already put together, I think, a wonderful lineup for next semester. The lineup is over here in these red sheets that I see a number of you already have. Please pick one up before you leave, and we hope to see a lot of you next winter. And now for tonight's guest. Jack Riddle has taught poetry for over 30 years at Hope College, where he also founded the college's Visiting Writer Series. He is the author of four poetry collections, including Against Elegies, which was selected for the 2001 Chapbook Award from the Center for Book Arts in New York City. He is co-author with Peter Shackle of Approaching Poetry, Perspectives and Responses, and co-editor with Peter Shackle of the soon-to-be-released 250 Poems from St. Martin's Press. His poem, The Drywallers Listen to Sinatra While They Work, was chosen by David St. John for the 2002 Say the Word Poetry Award from the Ellipse Arts Center in Arlington, Virginia. Riddle's poems have been published in such literary magazines as Lit, The Georgia Review, Field, Poetry, Plowshares, Prairie Schooner, Gulf Coast, The Denver Quarterly, Chelsea, Free Lunch, The Journal, Passages North, and Poetry East. In 1996, the Carnegie Foundation named him Michigan Professor of the Year. Of his poems, U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins wrote, quote, "Against Elegies arises from a sense of curiosity about life in both its plain and puzzling aspects. These poems feel their way forward and are attentive enough to the reader to make us feel included. Happy accomplices to his search." Please join me in welcoming Jack Riddle.
Oh, thank you, Peter, very much. To hear it, to hear an introduction enunciated that clearly, joy. Can you hear me in the front? And I sure want to thank you, Stephanie, very much for all your work, and Diana Richard for dinner and friendship, making this happen, and thank you all for coming. I'm only sorry that I've cut into the crowd at the basketball game, so you've left some empty seats over there. Actually, I'm kidding. My father was a Division I basketball coach, believe it or not. So I thought I'd start off tonight by reading one poem, a coach poem. When my father was interviewed for Sports Illustrated, they asked him, you know, this is really weird. Your son's a poet. And my father said, no, that's not weird. He just writes stuff down, you know, about people's experiences. And what's really weird is I dress these guys up in these funny little outfits, you know, and they dribble a ball and try to put it through a ring. And X number of thousands of people come and watch them. And you come from New York and write about it. Now, that's what's really weird. This is a poem called Coach on Vacation. Swathed in number 4 copper tone, Coach sits in his beach chair, watching the Atlantic roll itself toward his toes, his belly white as a gull's, the sun playing him tight. He listens to the waves, the children squealing, the stockbrokers still talking big bucks as their wives try to coax them offshore, and the teenagers laughing as they roll under the cool water or whispering as they bake next to each other, fingers laced. Suddenly, he wants to buy some jeans, open his shirt, take his wife across state lines. But his brain's a gym. Every move he makes draws jeers. Even here, dreaming himself a surfer, builder of sandcastles, a stud who strolls the shoreline, or just leaning back into the sand to feel the salt air sift across his body, he can hear the catcalls. You're a bum, coach. You're a lousy bum. Now, better not do that, or I'll expect it after every one of these. And if it doesn't happen, then, you know, I'll be grasping for the water. What have I done? 30 years at one college, let alone a Calvinist college. My God, I didn't even know what a Calvinist was till I still don't know what a Calvinist was. I came from Pittsburgh. We have no Calvinists in Pittsburgh. There are no Calvinists in Pittsburgh. Yeah, it's Hope. Yes, which is one of the great oxymorons of our time. Yes, the Calvinist college called Hope. And I'm always trying to get even. This is a poem called The Materialism of Angels. You know, everybody's totally depraved with, the Calvinists. I don't know why what they think's going to happen in heaven. You know, their whole lives are spent, frowning and pointing. And all of a sudden, they're going to get up to heaven, and they're going, oh, my God, joy. I don't know how to do joy. So this is one of my vindictive poems here. 30 years. This is called The Materialism of Angels. It has a little, I have to do these. It has a little epigraph, That's why you can write the poems. You can go to the epigraph. The Materialism of Angels, the epigraph from Charles Eames, the designer, who would say that pleasure is not useful? Of course the angels dance. If not on the head of a pin, then along any boardwalk beside the ocean of stars. And they eat hot and spicy. Salsa, Tabasco, red peppers. They love mangoes. They can munch for hours on cashews. Olives sit in bronze bowls on the cherry tables next to their canopy beds, where the solace of pillows swallows their sweet heads and the quiet of silk lies across their happy backs. They know the altruism of material things. They want us to say, they want to say to us, we'll sleep next to you. Feel our soft and unimposing flutter across your shoulders, on your heartbroken feet. They want us to take, eat, to smell the wood, run our tired fingers over the rim of every glass, give our eyes the chance to see the metal bend and curve its way into the black oval of the chair. They want us to feel the holiness of scratching where it itches, rubbing where it hurts. They want us to take long, steamy showers and a nap. They know how easily we follow directions, hook the red wire to the front of the furnace, fill in only the top half of the life insurance form. But they have no manuals for joy. They can't fix anything we break. And they wonder why we never laugh enough, why we don't know that God is crazy for deep massage and loves to wail in alto sax whenever they dance. My father was a coach. My mother's side of the family were, believe it or not, circus people. That's the reason that I have never been able to adjust the reality. There was none in my childhood. I really grew up thinking that the norm was guys in funny little outfits shooting a ball through a ring and other people spinning rings on their hands, training wild animals and walking on wires. That was the norm. This is, half the time, I don't know if I just read poems in between talking or whether I'm talking. I don't know which it is. Some of you may and some of you may not know this, and this is a little bit longer intro. There's a great act in the circus. It's an elephant act. And you don't see it during the show. And each elephant has an elephant boy. Be it man or woman, it's an elephant boy. And this great act, before the show, the elephant, if it's a tent show, and you're only allowed to go to tent shows in my family, anything that's inside, that's not a circus. And the elephant pulls the great poles that lift the tent. And so you can see that between 7 and 10 in the morning. And then after the show comes down, the elephant boy has mastered this wonderful trick. where there's a chain strapped to the elephant's foot. And in the morning, the roustabouts have to pound in all the stakes all the way around, but they can't pull them out. And the elephant boy takes the elephant beautifully, one step at a time. The elephant walk up to the stake, and the elephant boy flips the chain in the air and makes a loop, falls down over the stake, gives the command, and the elephant lifts her foot and just pulls that stake out, drops it, and then just walks to the next thing. Lifts. You hear this clank, boom, boom. Next. And it's just a beautiful procession as the elephant and the elephant boy move around the ring. One time I asked one of the elephant boys, what's it mean, your elephant, to you? And he said, oh, she keeps me off drugs. And the title of this poem is that, She's Kept Me Off Drugs. That's what the elephant boy says, standing beside Susie, waiting to lead her under the half-risen big top. She will pull the center pole into place, and the patched and restitched 100-yard-long stretch of sky blue canvas streaked with stars will lift itself toward the clouds hanging over the lot. Every morning, almost to the second at 10 a.m., after the roustabouts, staggering from bad wine, heat, and 3 hours sleep in the sweat-drenched bunks stacked five high in the semi that hauls them from job to job, have driven the stakes, looped the guy ropes over the side poles, and unfolded the unrolled midway and main tent. After the great hum of the power generator has been hooked into the lights that tonight will glow across the cornfields, Susie hears the elephant boy holler, huh, Susie, huh, and feels the quick, dull thwack of his hook against her side. She, swaying like a great gray ship docked in the daylight, lifts her accustomed trunk, and dust flying off her back, trots as she has every workday for 40 years in through the main entrance, and stands where the roustabouts will later piece together each fading arc of the red center ring. The boy hooks the enormous clank of chain to her leathered harness, then again shouts, huh, Susie, huh? And she, with a slow wave of her crusty ears, caked and sore from 1,000 bites, walks with the indifference of sovereignty to the far end of the tent, pulls the great pole up and into place, the pole itself carrying the tent on its tip. The sky and all its stars rise from the dust high above the roustabouts. The handful of locals, the bored frown of the straw boss. Then higher still until the boy yells, Susie, stop. Quiet fills the canvas, settles with the dust where each ring will try to hold the crowd, surrounds the juggler trying a new trick. Then Susie seems to pull the stillness out behind her as she leaves the tent. The work begins again, the clatter of the plank seats notched into place on the scaffolds, the clang of the riggings, fittings, and bolts, the dull thud of perches, stools, props, and arcs of the rings being dropped in their spots. Better than the show, the boy says to a local on the way out. They do often say that. One said that right behind me one time. It's better than the show. This next poem is an elegy for my father and in a way for John. There, in this elegy appears where he grew up. Where he grew up was named Goat Shit Hill. And I'm very proud to have written an elegy in which the words goat shit appear. So when that happens in this elegy, be not alarmed. I had this strange experience, which I'm sure is universally strange. You've all likely had this happen at one time and certainly will. And that is when my father died, a little bit of me left and a lot of him stayed. It's called "I Am Wearing Your Shirt." When your words left your hands, the only place silence holds us to the earth opened. Somewhere a child opened a door. Somewhere a mother looked out a window. You lived in your hands, alive in bread dough, along the handles of tools, holding the endless usefulness of rags. In all things, a firm grip, you told me. And at the end, you wanted only your hands. The snow that comes in the mornings brings each of your words. The water forms around your and, your either, not, and yes. They land. They just land. Sometimes they fall all day and into the next. Sometimes they melt before noon. You never waited. In the spring, you forced the shoots, even the blooms. The trays waited on the coffee table, the refrigerator, the floor of the family room. We gave one to anyone who stopped. They were gone by May. Yesterday, I found a photograph. I'm sitting on your shoulders. Or is it you sitting on your father's shoulders? Or is it your grandfather sitting on his beer wagon holding his team of tired horses? At the funeral, you walked through the house, collecting your garden tools, cookbooks, and sweatshirts, while each visitor laid the bud of a rose on your chest. They formed a heart within the heart of your arms and folded hands. I imagine them opening in your ashes. Every morning for 51 years, you woke and began by whispering, "This is the best part of the day," and laid your arm across her back. I am wearing your shirt. Now when I walk, I wear your hat. In the garden, I wear your gloves. Here, the land is flat. You grew up in the clay hills, always at an angle. And growing up on Goat Shit Hill, looking out over the sullen open hearths, the tired smoke of the mills, the smudged strip of heartless coal, you took shot after shot at the hoop your father rammed into the ridge behind your house, knowing any miss could send you down a mile after the disrespected ball. The house is cold now. Cold as spring turning itself into bloom. And we wait at the window. You always stepped aside to let every question have its way. And your God wanted no attention at all. Yesterday, when I dug into our garden's matted earth, I felt your hand slide into mine as if it were putting on a glove. And we went together into the awkward ground, turned the soil, let it slip between our fingers. Where have you walked in a year? The center of snow, the center of each amen, of every word we've tried to keep. Now, on this still April afternoon, one more year to the day you came to stay within us, the tree's negative space waits for leaves. And wearing your shirt, I look out into the wood where the end of each branch touches the air's one silence. How you love this dust, this light on the side of the house. What have I done? Now let's follow the elegy with a poem called "Against Elegies." Against Elegies. This is a rant. I'm tired of death's allure, of how the old beggar makes me think that rowing across the river is somehow richer, more serious than the center of a pomegranate or my dog's way of sleeping on his paws. I'm tired of the beauty of the elegy, the tone-deaf lyricism of it all. I want death to listen for a while to Bud Powell or Art Blakey, to have to stare for 7 hours at Matisse. I want him to do stand-up and play the banjo, to have to tap dance and juggle, to play Trivial Pursuit and weed my garden. I'm tired of how death throws his voice, gets us to judge a begonia, a song in the shower, a voice, an old dog. I want life's ragged way of getting along, the wasted afternoon and empty morning, the sloppy kiss. I want to stagger along between innings. I want the burnt toast, the forgotten note, and the lost pillowcase, the dime novel, and the silly putty of it all. My grandmother had a great saying. She used to say, "Why would you do something when you could do nothing?" We just, a month ago, we were in Italy, and there's a wonderful Italian saying, some of you may know, "La dolce far niente," the sweetness of doing nothing. Only by doing nothing can you taste the sweetness. Otherwise, you're just sightseeing. We have two Clumber Spaniels. If you know what Clumber Spaniels are, they're the only passive spaniel. They're an old breed. There's only about 1,500 of them. And they sort of look like if a St. Bernard married a Basset, they'd have a Clumber. And when they're little, when they're just born, you can hold them upside down your hand. They won't even move. And in the dog books, it really says this. In the dog books, it says, "Clumber Spaniels love to go for a walk, but they just as soon stay on the couch." And they do. The Clumber and the Manatee are my totem animals. And we're nearing the season, and, you know, I've also, we have the ball game, and we have 90,000 people watching Santa come to town tonight, I guess, right? And my people. So a little holiday poem. Out in the fields with the dogs a week before Christmas. Their great white heads take me deeper into the snow. They lift their noses into the air, then push further into the drifts, finding the lost smells held to the roots, the weeds, and matted ground cover. They know the deer have walked here, their own heads lifted high into the morning. I can only imagine what worlds fill the dogs' heads, what takes form from the thousand smells we can never know. Their dreams made from all these grasses, mud, scat, and fur. Maybe something takes the scents and stirs them into some bewilderment of wolves walking a ridge. We walk on. At home, the Christmas tree is trimmed with strings of tiny lights, glitter-covered glass, tinsel angels, nesting birds, toy drums, and the withering paper globes we made when we were children. You are baking kolaches. You are baking them the way my father did, rolling the soft dough over the apricots, raisins, apples, and poppy seed. The snow is falling harder. The dogs look back, then run to my side, sit and gnaw at the ice frozen to their feet. This year, it will be the two of us and the dogs. We've been told the full moon is to be the brightest it's been in 133 years. We'll watch it through the bedroom window as it crosses through the trees low in the southern sky, the dogs asleep at the foot of the bed. You get tired of your own voice, all of us at different times do, and when you're writing, you can get tired of your own voice pretty quickly. And so I decided to make, I've always loved folk artists. I mean, that's nothing, everybody, I suppose. That's kind of an easy thing to love, but and envied their lack of self-consciousness, you know. They don't sit there and worry about being evaluated or passing their MFA exams or any of that stuff, getting published or all that, all the trappings that make you wonder if you're really being honest in what you do. So I decided, well, I'll just make up a whole bunch of folk artists, you know. I'll just have them talk and feel what that's like. And so I did, and this is, I'll just read one of them. This is a folk artist, and it's all, it really was, it was a wonderful release, you know, to do those personas and just let them talk. Not worry about your own self. This is a guy who collects cranks, and it has the brilliant title "The Crank Collector," and he is speaking. The Crank Collector. I'd love to rust. I just sit there turning away. That crank there couldn't turn a thing. I put cranks on anything. Look over there, how I put that one on that lawn deer. I wasn't sure where to fasten it. I found this old stuffed chair and put a crank on it. And I thought this stump should have one. And that one on the rowboat, I first put that one on our bed. I find cranks everywhere. They'll just turn up. In the woods, for instance, or behind a garage. I found one once in a cemetery. That one on the side of the house, I found digging in my garden, planting some spurge. You know, there are 2,000 kinds of spurge. That one's a double handle. You can swing it arm over arm. This one I painted green before I stuck it into that window box, and I took that one from the attic of my grandmother's house. I thought she'd like it fastened to her Bible. I think she would, too. My mom has written me a letter every week for 30 years. And she lives in this little town, and she writes them all in pencil. And she deeply believes in the pencil. And nothing past the pencil. She's a Luddite. Always in pencil. And it's wonderful to get them because she was also one of the first environmental, you know, recyclists. Because she writes them, if I would send her this poem, I'd get the letter back written on the back of the poem. Everyone. So she lives in this little town, and I always get all the her letters, and I turn them over, you know, and I find out what this went on in her church that week, you know, or it's something in the senior place where she lives. All the events will be on the back, you know, and had peas for dinner, whatever it is. So I thought I should try to respect that pencil and her. This is a poem called The History of the Pencil. And there are a couple allusions in it, but, you know, it's always insulting to explain allusions to an audience, so I'll do that. Henry David Thoreau, his family were pencil makers. Toulouse-Lautrec, painter. Leonardo da Vinci, you know, he had a wielded arm and he did mirror writing. You know, he wrote that way, so you had to write it in the mirror. Cavemen appear. that's enough. Okay. And this poem, a little bit like that, this one's a little long, too, so, you know, feel free to just drift off. It's hard enough listening to poems, you know. I always drive for 2 hours going, are they crazy? I mean, is somebody really going to show up for this thing? No, this one's a little long. The History of the Pencil. Maybe I should do this for Mike. History of the Pencil. Even as you sit staring at the light on the new computer that came with speakers and discs that hold golf games, soundtracks from the movies of the 40s, and a way to rhyme every word except those stubborn loners, silver, purple, and orange, you have to wonder how this most elemental of juxtapositions, this marriage that few families would allow, this wedding of wood and lead, wandered into some pause in the daydreams of whom? Even Thoreau, that son of the pencil-making family who recorded every move of a leaf, who listed each essential object for a 12-day trek into the woods of Maine, matches, soap, 2 pieces, old newspapers, 3, and blanket, 7 feet long, neglected to note his pencil. Imagine, held by the keeper of Walden, as he, in all his assured solitude, attended to everything in his burrowing but you, the scribbler's one essential companion. Wouldn't you feel much like the friend who has been there all along, who leaves quietly out the back door when the famous come to call? Or the good dog who stays loyal day after abandoned day? Or the name changed to something more alluring that sits and wonders why you are walking away? I am a pencil, said Toulouse-Lautrec to one of the rouged and rowdy-legged dancers he let become a gray line kicking high over his lonely head in the dance hall. Even Leonardo, whose mind would never let anything escape from the possibility of being better, wrote those mad, mirror-written obsessions, his maimed right hand dangling like a sash, and sketched his own hand sketching, without ever thinking that the tedious brush could give way to something humbler, more subservient. And did it never enter the mind of some poor hunter-gatherer, who surely heard the tunes of the very beasts and berries he searched for, I'd like to keep what I'll likely forget. Maybe if I... Was it there that his mind opened into the first existential blank? And when he told her and all his cave companions what he'd like to be able to do, did they each just nod and go back to picking out what had gathered in their hair throughout the day? So now, as you sit stunned at the mere accumulation of words filed, edited, viewed, inserted, formatted, spun into websites, downloaded and upgraded into numbers nothing but infinity seems able to record, even now, on some desk, maybe yours, in an old jelly jar or a ceramic elephant with a hole in its back that your niece in third grade gave you for Christmas, or in a German beer stein or hand-painted wooden Chinese calligrapher's pen holder, sprouts a fistful of pencils, Retke's preservers of dolor, each one waiting, as it always has, to lie like a faithful love between your thumb and finger, to let your words be the only ones they will ever know, even as they give themselves to the alchemy of everything, becoming empty phrases, an X to mark the spot, reminders to pick up bread and coffee, maybe a note written to a friend whose dog has died. We're supposed to, anybody in this business of poems is supposed to be able, you're taught, you have to learn to take rejection. You have to learn to take criticism, distance yourself. And I always think, I always realize, you know, what a scam. That's sort of like blaming the victim, you know. They really get away with that stuff all the time. And they just tell you that. And they say, well, you know, your poem sucks. Now you should be able to handle that. And I think, you know, yeah, that's like you walk up to my daughter and say, her ears are too big. Yeah, I can handle that. That's fine, you know. She's really ugly. Thank you. Yes, I can handle that. That's just fine. I mean, what are they thinking? So I had this great losing streak going here of about 26 rejections in a row. And at that point, you just say, what have I done to myself? So this is, this poem is filled with these little this is disgusting, but these little references, these little poetry references. So it's sort of like a Where's Waldo poem, you know? If you hear one and you write, oh, that's William Carlos Williams, you know, you put up your hand or something. We'll make it a game. We'll have somebody win. You can win this. It's called Resume.
As an epigraph, 26 rejections in a row.
They just keep coming. These 2x3-inch, oh, by the way, you should never do that in a reading either. You must know this. Rejection slips have all these lovely little things on them that say, you know, after keeping your poems for 2.5 years, we've decided they're just not quite right for us, you know, and then they, you know, that's just fine. Thank you very much.
So that's what, okay, resume, blah, blah, blah. They just keep coming, these 2x3-inch RSVPs, saying, sorry to say no, or we regret that these do not meet our needs, or not for us, or your party is simply not the kind of thing that we enjoy. Please do not invite us in the future. We don't like the games you play, your choice of wines, those greasy sausage balls on the tip of a toothpick. I have wasted my life. I should have lain in a hammock at anybody's farm. Let my daydreams veer from their synaptic leaps and drift into the wood where they might land in the deft, nimble, fastidious fingers of a hungry raccoon. I'm a loser in the poetry casino. I drop my quarters in the slot and get 2 peaches and a prickly pear, a cherry blossom, red wheelbarrow, and a dulcimer. I sit in literature's bingo parlor hearing G11, N4, then O26, and then from the far end of the room, bingo! My persona has an identity crisis. My inner emperor has no clothes, no ice cream either, and now I'm writing this, while along the stream that gently twists behind our house, my wife plants foxglove, barrenwort, clusters of ferns, while our dogs sleep, their huge heads peacefully snoring on their soft paws, while a robin feeds her young, their new heads stretching from the nest in the branches above my head. And in a way, that's kind of a little love poem. And this next one is a little bit of a love poem. Some of you have heard me say this before. I don't read novels very well. It's really hard because I'll go for a while and then I just get stuck on something and I just daydream. And then they're so, you know, and then you have to keep going. And then I always hear people start, you know, well, it was a little tough at the beginning, but by about page 87, you know. So I usually start about page 87. I think that's a good hint. And also, you know, I don't think this is so bad. Even though I'm in an English department and have barely read more than maybe 10 novels, I don't think this is so bad because I love being in them. So I have this new thing now, and I recommend this. You know, sometimes you just want to go be in a bog, you know, so you get hardy out, you know, and you open and you find a little bog for a couple of pages, just hang around, you know, and then you just need to go to London and you get Dickens out for a little while, or you need some Pomo, whatever, you know, go down south with Lee Smith for 10 minutes, that's all. She doesn't care. I mean, she doesn't care. She's just glad you're there for a little bit. You just drop in. It's sort of a drop-in novel thing, yeah? And the other thing is that all my colleagues are brilliant, you know, and they all read and write books that have colons. And I just dream of that, you know? Like, what would that be like to write a book of poems, you know, and against elegies, colon, the elucidation of loss in our... I'd love to do that. So I look at those books that have colons, and I like those books. And I was reading this one, it was called... This was the title, The Rainbow, From Myth to Mathematics. I've read that for a while. And in this book was this quote, there is no precise date at which mythology gave way to science. So now, if you're asked, you now can say, you know, I learned that at Michigan State tonight, that there's no precise date. Now, there's a lot of things wrong with that statement, as you probably already know, right? First of all, it suggests that mythology has nothing to do with the truth, and of course, that's the only place there is any truth, is within mythology. So that whole thing's wrong. And this guy got all right with this, you know, with a colon and everything. And the other thing, there's an implied notion that there's some sort of science is the problem. If any of you have been around, you know, real science, you know, that's as mysterious and mythical as anything else. So, tantrum slash colon love poem. The title of this is Rainbow. No colon. Rainbow. There is no precise date at which mythology gave way to science. In this poem, there are again some allusions. Wordsworth, you know, my heart leaps up when I behold a rainbow. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so Wordsworth shows up. I'm not in Holland, Michigan, or at Hope College. Noah. Okay. It's a joke. Plato had a friend, Philip, related in the back in the Greeks, and Philip was a man who actually was before the uncertainty principle, beat Heisenberg to the touch, because he said that things change or move if we move, if we're looking at them. Way back, he told that to Plato. Plato said, Phil. Rainbow. So science is the bully on the playground. The guy who says Babe Ruth was just a drunk. The kid who rolls his eyes the day the trees all bud. You know elves live under your porch. That God loves puppets. That the wind comes from a witch's cave. And birds sing just to sing. What if Wordsworth, strolling along the lakes, looked up, took out his pen, and speculated how the color came from light refracted through the drops of rain that formed around some dust? And what if Noah, crazed with the smell of dung, the impatience of every creature on the earth, what if this wild builder of faith, when he saw that covenant of color draping over his mad zoo, and tried to tabulate the cubits in the rainbow's length, forgetting about the dove, the olive branch, dry land. And what do we make of Philip, Plato's less than certain pal? He scribbled in his notebook that the rainbow wasn't stable after all. It moved as the observer moved, and somewhere over the rainbow was farther away than any bluebird could ever fly. So, if science is uncertain as tomorrow's weather, I think I'll say the rainbow, like most everything. This poem, elephants, the hurricane along the Georgia coast, my daughter's scribbled chalk across the sidewalk, is not just one more worn anonymous effect in causes long and flagrant history. I'll say the rainbow simply comes. Light may bend, reflect, refract, but why then color? Why Mozart from a catgut string? And why this morning, when I saw that we were out of coffee, did I look up and see you in the garden, staking our tomatoes in the rain? How are we doing? Can we do a couple more? Are you okay? Do we need to stretch?
No, there will not be a 10-minute intermission.
One more circus poem. This is a poem about the juggler. This is a kinetic poem, which is really pretentious to say, but I wanted to see if you could do a poem, you know, like that moved. The only thing it was about was just this moving, not reflecting, or just moving. Any snotty illusions in here? Okay, after the lion tamer. As the roustabouts tear down the cage that held the big cats, the juggler enters, dances to the front of the center ring, carrying three bowling pins, one red, one green, one yellow. Tosses the red one toward the trapeze hanging above his head. As it tumbles toward him, he flings the green one, then the yellow, catching, tossing, catching the red one, the green one, the yellow one, the red, the green, the yellow, red, green, yellow, and now he hops up on a star-covered purple ball, keeps the red, green, yellow pins spinning up to their peak, then down, and then he extends one leg and loops a silver hoop around his ankle. Then the cymbals crash, and he flips backward off the ball, each pin falling fast into his hands, the silver hoop now spinning down to land around his neck. He bows, and then a drum roll, soft swish of cymbals. And through the entrance dashes a chihuahua in a striped and pointed clown hat. It jumps onto the juggler's outstretched hand, stands on its front paws, the juggler turning slowly full circle to show the crowd. Then the juggler flings the tiny dog, and it lazily arcs its way up toward the top of the tent, then down to land on the juggler's other hand. He grabs an umbrella from a roustabout, tosses it, the chihuahua now following the tumbling umbrella, and then he adds a bright blue derby hat, all three now chasing one another, a hallucinatory Mobius strip painted by Magritte, all moving as if there is no wobble in the world. Suddenly, a shot rings out. The umbrella drops, its tip sticking in the sawdust. The juggler with sparkling insouciance leans on it, extends his hand like a common dandy, and the dog lands, his little hat in perfect place. And then the derby spins down last, settles jauntily on the juggler's head, a bullet hole dead center. I think poems should be fun. You know, I sit down, I'm going to write it. I always tell my students all poems aren't worth reading, but they're all worth writing. Yeah? I'm always worried, is my poem any good? And I always say, was it valuable to write? You know, quit being a little capitalist. Product-centered. You know, even there's this buzzword, process-centered education, you know? But every time I go here excited about somebody's going to talk about process, it's always about, and you know this process is so great because it leads, and look what comes out of, oh, shoot. You know, I thought we were just going out in the backyard and shoot some hoops. My mother keeps finding these articles about my father. And by the way, this is the time in the program when the countdown thing helps everybody, so. Three left. She keeps finding these articles about my father. And she found this one a couple of months ago, and it's just knocked me out. This is a sports article written by a sports writer about this basketball coach. And all through the article, it talks about all the stuff he invented and all the championships and the NCAA and the Final Four and this great, great, successful coach. And on and on and on it goes with all the accolades about him. And then it comes to the final paragraph. This is the final paragraph in a sports article. It's hard to picture Riddle as a jock. He uses metaphors continually, the low-pitched, reassuring voice comparing basketball players with actors, coaches with symphony conductors. He urges everyone to just try a sport, anything. Go for a hike, ride a bike. He's not a fanatic. His sports involvement outside of work is comprised mostly of watching a few college basketball games on TV. And he watches only while writing a letter or doing something else. And now here's the kicker. Sports article, sports writer, right? Last. But what he really likes is gardening. I enjoy flowers.
I like transplanting them, creating them, watching them grow. Some vegetables, but mostly flowers. We all want Bobby Knight to end an article thing, you know? Mostly flowers. My father gardening in heaven. The flowers are no taller here. The cosmos carry their saucers of burgundy and white. The fuchsias dangle their puckered blossoms no farther down than they do on earth. Every flower adds its promiscuity of scent, its audacity of color to the unencumbered hues of heaven. My father imagines snow on the mountains spreading across the clouds, succulents thriving in the fierce sunlight, bleeding heart drooping in the perfect air. There are no slugs peeling the leaves, no aphids ravenous in a flower's veins. The days are bereft of drought. The nights solicit no unwelcome frost. My father, sleeping under the apple blossoms, dreams of spider mites, leaf hoppers, and lace bugs cutting across his every plant. And he wakes up shaking and reaching for a spray. Adam turns from his hoeing, smiles, Eve waves out the window. My father nods, stands up, takes his rake and pulls it gently over the straight and narrow furrows he had loosened in the soft, sweet loam. Mostly flowers. The other thing that was a little unsettling was that the title of this article was Riddle Pitt, that's Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh, Pitt's grand old man. He's younger here than I am now. Oh, let's see, I remember my first reading without hair, and then my first reading with glasses. I look forward to my first reading without teeth, I guess. Coming up.
No, I'd like to read a poem on a rainbow. I read that already. It's in here twice.
My mom, when she was a kid, was a Sinatra freak, and she got enough together to make her way to New York and hurled herself on the stage at Frank's feet. You know, she was one of those teeny boppers. When my sister and I were kids, she made sure we went to see the Beatles. She saved up her money to go, so we'd all go see the Beatles. And we saw the Beatles, 1964 Beatles. And in her, she's in her 80s now. She's well over 4'8". And she's just a lovely, round, funny, dear character. And she's madly in love with Bruce Springsteen. And she has been to every concert. He's coming to Pittsburgh. And she got the call. She has her tickets the first day they came out. And a big wig in Pittsburgh is going to stretch limo her to the concert. And she gets out, and they all know her. Here she comes. She has everything. She has every CD, every video, every shirt, black T-shirt, you know, sweatshirt. A few years ago, I got her sweatshirt for Christmas. Born in the USA a long time ago. It's out there. Get it for your grandma. It's great. In the family room, she has, you know, all the usual photo wall of cousins and grandpas and everybody. And Bruce. Bruce is there. It's right up on the wall. We were redoing this house a bit ago, and she came to visit during the work. And it was one of those eight-month jobs where these two guys, Al and Tom, came to live with us every day for 8 months, you know. Get up. Oh, Al's here.
And they were our children.
Well, she came to visit, and this is the next to last poem.
Little poem about that called, which Peter was nice enough to mention, The Drywallers Listen to Sinatra While They Work.
They really did. This morning, my mother, here for the holidays, is washing the breakfast dishes when Al, wiry, coated with drywall dust, takes her hand and says,
"I bet you love Sinatra."
Dance. The acrid smell of plaster floats through the room. Frank is singing All or Nothing at All, and Al leads my mother under the spinning ballroom lights across the new subfloor. He is smiling. She is looking over his shoulder. The other guys turn off their sanders. Al and my mother move through the dust, two kids back together after the war. Sinatra holds his last note. "It's been 7 years since I danced," my mother says. "Then it was in the kitchen, too." Al smiles again, says, "Come on then, sweetheart," biting off his words like the ends of the good cigars he carries in his pocket. Sinatra's singing My Funny Valentine, and my mother lays her hand in Al's. They dance again, she looking away when she catches my eye, Al leading her back across the layers of dust. And I'll say thank you with this poem. And it's easy to say thank you, but it's wonderful to mean it. So I mean it. It's just a crazy art, and to think that somebody would come out to take part in it is wonderful, because it really. I don't like the word communication when it comes to any art. I think communication is what I'm doing now, talking at you. And I'm not very good, and I don't want to be very good at communicating. Every once in a while, there'll be a couple in my office, and they'll say, "We're having trouble, and we're thinking about breaking up." Good God knows why they're in my office, okay? But, and they'll say, I guess it's sensitive poem guy. But they're in there, and I'll say, "Well, what seems to be the trouble, And invariably, it's this: we just can't communicate. And I always like, "Well, hell, nobody can communicate. What? That's not a problem. That's no reason to break up. Get out of here. Find something better than that. Jeez, that's not possible." I always think it's about communion. You make the art, you make the poem, and if it leads, and so, thank you. Very much. Even though I'll drive the whole way home going, "I screwed that up. I know it. I screwed that up." So thank you with this poem called Keeping On. But of course he couldn't decide. One thing always led to another. Like the way the lady drove down the street. No, more like the way the dog, well, whatever it was not nearly as traumatic as the way the man two blocks over, or was it yesterday's mail? He was lost, or so it seemed, until he learned to plant onions amid the hollyhocks and realized that sticking spoons in one part of the garden attracted moonlight long after the flowers had faded. And so he bought 100 more spoons and arranged them throughout the flowers. He watered them and watched them stay the same and let them take the moonlight. And one day he realized he'd forgotten about the lady and the way the dog and the man two blocks over and the mail. He found himself smiling as he sprinkled the spoons. Thank you very much.
Now we come to the shy part of the program. They also said, you know, please hang around if you'd like, and if you'd like a book, there's books. If you'd like to ask a question or anything, or please feel comfortable doing that. Yes?
When did you start writing poetry?
No, I was asked that in our interview with Stephanie.
Why did you start writing then, and how have you changed as a...
Well, the when, and it always sounds like a snide comment, and I don't mean it that way at all, is that I never stopped. I think that everybody, you know, does things, and then usually we give them up because we believe it's not worth doing if, you know, unless you do it well. I have a command to all my students to think about the things they gave up because they don't do them well that really mattered to them. And when they graduate, I want to know that they're going across that stage and having brought those back into their lives. I think we should do them for other reasons than doing them well. So the first one was I just really never stopped. I paused along the way because you get discouraged and that sort of thing. And why? I started out writing songs. Some of you may know the poet Lee Young Lee, and I wrote songs for several years for his sister. And Lee Young was really little then. She said, one day Lee Young will be a great poet. And of course, if you know him, he is. And then she was married and wasn't going to sing anymore, and I didn't want to go through all that. So I started fiddling around with the impulse to write songs to see what would happen with poems. And they were terrible, and I worked with Paul Zimmer for 5 years, and he said the poems were terrible, and they were. And he told me that he would tell me when he thought I'd written a poem, and in the sixth year, he said, I think you've written a poem. I tell that story to Ellen Bryant Voigt, the poet, and she just gets enraged. She says, why, if you'd have done that with me, I'd have had you writing poems in, 6 weeks. Why? Because of what there's lots of reasons, but a big reason has to do with staying in touch with what really matters in a larger way. That I think this is pretty pretentious, but throughout our day we're distracted from the world that we hold within, and a lot of that world within, like the guy with the spoons, it needs watering and attended to and kept. So stay in touch is a wonderful little phrase. Stay in touch with imagination, or stay in touch with my little daughter who's now 27, or stay in touch with my father who's present but absent. A lot of things like that are the reasons why. Changed simply because, get older. Changed based on the world changing in a larger way. Less taking oneself less seriously and taking what you care about more seriously. I mean, his early poems were all embarrassed by, oh my God, did I really think I really took myself seriously, didn't I? Oh my gosh. There were other people who broke up with people too, and lost jobs and stuff. I wasn't the only one. Those kind of changes. I hope that's a helpful response. Anybody else? I'll try not to make it a long response. It's late. Thank you. Yes, yes.
I was just curious how your parents seem like very different people. I was wondering if you would tell us how they met.
They met in college. My dad was obviously a great athlete, but he was also a tremendous dancer. And my mother was going out with his roommate at the time, and my dad stole her away from him on the dance floor. They were jitterbug king and queen of the college they went to. And they were very different. And at the same time, they were they had very much in common, incredibly imaginative people. My father, really, if you study basketball history, he was a stunningly imaginative coach. Probably some of the stuff they're doing over there tonight, he came up with. I'm sure they are. They're probably doing a version of what's called the motion offense and what's called the matchup defense. And most coaches would trace it back. My father would deny it. He'd say, no, I just adapted other stuff. Well, we all do. So he was incredibly imaginative, see what a bias as a coach. And my mom was just nuts. So she was always imaginative. She's the worst mother in entire history of the planet. I mean, she was never even a mother. I mean, she would say to us, you know, my little sister, and she'd say, what should I do? I mean, she'd tell you, yeah, they raised me. They raised me. She'd say that if she were here. So it's not a behind her back comment. Yeah, she's really crazy. Really is. 82. Yes.
You seem to know some of the other adults in the room.
Yeah, I have these groupies, you know, they're my roadies. Where are we going next, guys? Mike? Richard? Andrea, Sarah? Yeah. I wouldn't have anybody here but you if it weren't for them, right? What are you doing here? Who are you? And your question about these rummies is? Oh, wonderful writers in the back. And this is Roger Moore, one of his cinematographers, a documentary maker, John Prusak, parents of a former student of mine, two of my students back there. I met you where?
Ludington.
I was going to email you, actually, that I was reading here, but it wasn't a workshop. That's it. Yeah. Who else do I know? Did I leave anybody out? Stephanie I met tonight. Paul? Yes? Yeah. Oh, my gosh. What are you doing here? Oh, really? Oh, you poor guy. You got dragged here, huh? Oh, yeah, yeah, you. Well, yeah, of course. Yes?
My granddaughter is a student of yours.
You're kidding me.
Alicia Abood.
Abood?
Oh, mom.
You're kidding. You are not your sister. See, we know what to say. Are you her mom? You're making that up. Oh, I'm crazy about her. I just wrote her an email today. Yeah.
She was waiting to hear from
you. Oh, man.
She's so thrilled that we were going to come and hear you.
Oh, man. That's just wonderful. Wow.
She's.
Oh, what a joy. Oh, geez. Should I start over? You know, what did I. How about some of those snide. Uh-oh. You going to pull her out of that Calvinist place now? Yeah. Okay, the president's address is 30 years, they can't touch me. Yes.
You can tell me if I'm all right in what I'm going to say here. But what really struck me, because I've not read any of your poems before, is the contrast and the juxtapositions that you're presenting. Here you can make fun of Calvinist colleagues, and then you can use words like communion.
Mm-hmm. That's
a very religious connotation.
Yeah.
You can write a poem called Anti-Elegies, and you can write a beautiful
thank you.
Elegy. You have a persona of wit and joy. I mean, I don't know you in reality,
right.
But you have a public persona like that.
Yeah.
And yet, your subjects are very serious. You can find the significant in what some people would call the insignificant.
Anybody write that down? I'll take that back. That's just lovely. And I'm very happy about that, because I think any of you who write, the accusation is often exactly what you've said, is at times, you know, there's not a lot that goes on in the poetry world, but the accusation is the guy never found his voice. He's all over the place. He's all over the map. There's no direction to it. I get poems published in magazines, but manuscripts don't hold together. I always get back. Each of these poems is pretty good, but it's not a book. It's just a hodgepodge. So I've had that all my life, and you know, I don't think it's going to get fixed. Do you, Jack? No, I don't think so.
It's a serious question I have, though.
Yeah. And actually, the humor is, you know, come on. That comes out of the story. Emma Kelly was my hero as a little boy, the sad clown. I mean, that's... Humor comes out of a sense of trying to hold up under what you can't hold up under.
What is your religious faith? To what extent does it affect your poetry?
Oh, it's very deep and non-denominational, and I would say it probably you know, that's dangerous ground based on definition, but it certainly influences.
You have a deep reverence.
Yeah, I'd say it's reverence. But, you know, now it's time to go run and hide again. It's reverence, and as soon as there's a definition, somebody's excluded, so then I leave. I don't know how I got tenure. I really don't. Where I work. I really must have lied my way through that one, you know? And my family background is very much that way, too. I mean, the metaphor of the circus is very real. It's an inclusive tent. And a basketball team is inclusive. It has to be. And so I can't join or ascribe myself to anything because that immediately excludes. Now, that sounds like a comment, negative comment to any of you who ascribe to something, and that's not what I mean by all. I mean that by my sensibility. I know you're not excluding. You'd welcome anybody in, but I just can't do it. I'm a rat. It's a radical democracy, the democracy of poems. And actually, it goes way back, too. I figured there has to be something real about it. If I can put it in a poem, everything belongs, you know, except the violence. I have a poem called The Man Who Wanted to Change the World, and it begins by wanting to change all the nouns. And the first noun he wants to change is gun, and he wants to change it to sassafras. Yeah. I'll pull my sassafras. Wait a minute. Yes, Stephanie.
After reading Don John.
Oh, my gosh, really? Is that okay? It's not too long. You had a quick question?
I had a question.
I'll find it while you ask the question, then I can dream up some answer.
Okay, good. Recently, I saw something on a PBS show, or heard something on a PBS show, about the value of poetry in the workplace.
Huh.
And I wondered if you'd heard about this or had any thoughts on it? Have you heard about this yet?
I don't think it'll add to the profit margin.
It reminded me of Billy Collins' initiative to have poetry read every day in schools.
Yeah.
Sure. But I just heard it flash through something.
I had not heard about that. No. I do want poetry to be useful. I want us to change the word of useful bigger. I had two amazing experiences last year after 9/11. At Christmas, I read in New York City, and then later I read in Washington, D.C. Now, please don't hear that as anything about me. I mean, that was an amazing experience. And all I could do when I got up there was to say, you know, this is not going to do anything, but for maybe an hour or so, we can get close to having things the way we deserve to have them. And that was the best that we could do. And in that sense is what I mean by useful. So if it was useful in that world that way, that'd be all right. Yes?
I heard about the new Shakespeare.
There is a CEO, James Autry, is that his name, I think, who writes some beautiful, beautiful poems. And Bill Moyers did a thing with him, too. Yeah. Okay, here we go. I have to give a little intro to this. And this will maybe appeal to that same thing you ask about. Again, and I have a couple of my students here, and as you know, where we are, they do a lot of praying. a lot of praying. And I'm Czechoslovakian. That's what Riddle is. And you know, I moved from Pittsburgh out to this area, and I learned no PDA out here. That's, you know, and some of you were raised that way, no public displays of affection. Now, Czechoslovakians cannot obey that. That's not a possibility in their lives, all right? The more public displays of affection, the better, as far as we're concerned. You know, my sister sends her kid off to get a loaf of bread, and she comes back, and it's like she's just returned from Nam, you know? They're just, oh, my God, you did it. How'd you do it? It's wonderful, perfect. It's not what I wanted, but, oh, hon, you know? It's just, everything is big affection, big affection. But what we're also taught is no PDP. Now, I'm going to offend some people, and I don't mean to. Boy, is that a cop-out. Yeah, I do. No public displays of prayer. We were taught, you know, like the Bible, go in the closet and pray if you're going to pray. No public displays. It puts, you know, there's something not. Anyway, no PDP. We could be the PDA. Now, also there's this injunction, biblical injunction, that you likely know, which is pray without ceasing. Now, you see where they, at Hope College, where they pray a lot, it's still not there yet. And I always want to say, now, wait a minute. It tells you to pray without ceasing. Now, how are you going to do that? I mean, just 47 times a day is not even close. Not close, you know. And then I have a Yiddish God. And I have a Yiddish God, you know, and I go down to a local restaurant, just get a pie after the poetry, piece of pie at the poetry. And if you're in Holland, Michigan, you get a piece of pie. They bring out the Russes. You get a little strawberry rhubarb pie. You sit down and eat that. Before you talk, oh. And I always hear this Yiddish God going, what, eat the pie, my God, what, eat it. You know, I'm busy, I got things, it's a piece of pie, best eat the pie. I don't have time, I can't be listening, I can't, no. I got things, you know. So I'm struggling with that, and I read this book, it had a colon. It was a book on prayer and meditation by the Benedictine monk, John Chapman. I love the Benedictines because they have a vow of hospitality. And the other vows are, you know, Czechoslovakians, it's excess, you know. So we're it's going to be tough to pull off those other vows. But hospitality in an excess, that sounds really wonderful. So this in this book, Dom John Chapman said, pray as you can, not as you can't. And we'll say goodnight with this and thank you again. After reading Dom John Chapman, Benedictine Abbot, pray as you can, not as you can't. My prayers will sit on the backs of bedraggled donkeys, in the sidecars of Harleys, in the pockets of night watchmen, on the laps of widows. They will be the stones I walk by, the smudges I leave on anything I touch, the last place the last snow melts. They will be brown. Weekdays, potato pancakes. They will stick to the undersides of porches, docks, dog paws, and carpets. When I'm sick, my cough will carry them. When you leave in the morning, they will sink into the bed, the sofa, every towel. I will carry them in the modesty of my feet. Everything will be praying. My dog will be petitioning for mercy when he stops to sniff a post. Every window in our house will be an offering for supplication. The birds at the feeder will be twitching for my sins. I will say my prayers are bread dough, doorknobs, golf tees, any small and nameless change of heart. When I forget my prayers, they will bundle up and go out on their own, across the street, down into the basement, or into a small town with no mayor where there's a single swing in the park. When I forget, they'll know I was watching TV, the sky, or listening to Basie, remembering the way my mother and father jitterbugged to the big band station. He pulling her close, then spinning her out across the green kitchen floor. Thank you very much.